Hi, I'm Josh.
And I'm Lindsay.
And this is the Hideaway Podcast, episode 76.
Seb Sea Pulp. That's Taiwanese. It's the Monday before Christmas break or Hanukkah.
And you haven't heard from us since Thanksgiving, so sorry for a little bit of a delay, but we have been recording some good episodes to drop over the holiday break.
Yes, we have.
And we've seen a couple shows in the last 2 weeks, one with a pretty crazy title.
Halfway Bitches Go Straight to Heaven. It is by Stephen Adley Gurgis, who is a wonderful playwright, won a Pulitzer Prize for the Mother Effer with the Hat. And he also wrote one other play that I didn't see. But he's a really great playwright.
Between Riverside and Crazy?
Between Riverside. Actually, I did see that play. His whole kind of MO is writing a play with a kind of a larger cast, a Latina-based cast, and really creating like a community around these characters, which I think he does incredibly well. He has these plays with all these people, or I don't know, this Halfway Bitches didn't have like a main character, I would say. Every character felt like you got their own story. Maybe there's one too many characters. It's an 18-person cast.
With a goat.
With a goat, which I also thought was
unnecessary. On stage goat.
Yeah. There was a goat and once on this island too. But it was really great. It's a lot of stuff that you've never really seen. It's really fixed around this halfway house that is a woman's halfway house. So it's all these women who are abused or are drug addicts or homeless, and they all live in this house together. And one of the main arguments in this house is that there's a transgender woman, and should she be allowed to be there because she's not a physiologically born woman. And it's a great, interesting debate on stage, and the actors are incredible. And it's 3 hours, and I enjoyed them. I enjoyed my 3 hours.
All the way through?
I mean, at the end, I was like, okay, I'm a little uncomfortable on the seats, but it was great. It's at Atlantic Theater Company, one of our fave theaters.
But I think you can expect to see this try to move to Broadway. Scott Rudin, who's a big-time producer, enhanced it. For those who don't know what the term enhance means, sometimes a commercial producer will give money to a nonprofit to make the show bigger in hopes that it's successful. And in exchange for giving that money, they get to be the ones to take it to Broadway. And this seems trying to be fit into the mold of The Ferryman, which won a Tony last year. And I think we talked about in the podcast, which also had a massive cast.
Yes.
And also has some relation to this nonprofit Atlantic.
Yeah. And if you watch Orange is the New Black, the woman who plays Daya's mom, she's Latina. She is one of the characters in the show, and she is an incredible actress. I definitely would recommend it. It's not for the faint of heart. If you get offended by cursing and foul language and nudity,
don't go.
But if you're cool with all that, definitely go. It's definitely a play like I've never seen, so I really enjoyed it.
Speaking of shows that we, have seen before and aren't really that much like anything else, is the Broadway show Beetlejuice. We saw this back in the summer, early summer, went in with super low expectations, and it really blew us away. Like, we thought, Beetlejuice turned into a property. How could this be all that good? Previous podcast guest Lorenzo Pizzoni worked on it, so we were curious to see how he had done the sort of physical theater comedy aspects of it. Went in with very low expectations, and it really blew us away. And what's interesting about the Beetlejuice story, particularly at the moment, is that when it opened, it was selling pretty badly. I mean, bad is comparative. It was grossing under $800,000 a week, which sounds like a lot of money, but for Broadway.
Well, even before it made it to Broadway, it did an out-of-town tryout in Chicago and just got absolutely panned. And I was surprised it even made it to Broadway.
But it made it to Broadway and it opened. It was doing not great, like just ticket sales-wise. And then over the course of the next couple of months and after the Tonys, it got better and better and better and better. And now it's actually doing quite well and is quite healthy.
Grossing over $1 million a week.
However, the news came out this week that it's being kicked out of its theater in order for The Music Man starring Hugh Jackman to come in.
Produced by Scott Rudin.
And what's interesting about the story is that it has to do with a thing called a stop clause. So when you rent a Broadway theater or most theaters in New York in general, the commercial producer signs a license agreement, which is kind of like a lease, but it's called a license agreement. And in that agreement, there's a section called the stop clause. And that says, if your show doesn't sell at least this many tickets per week over a 2-week period, then we reserve the right to kick you out. And this is sort of, if you can imagine, it's existed for like 100 years, but say there's a show in there that nobody likes, nobody wants to see it, but maybe the producer's really, really rich so they can keep covering the losses, but no one's going to it. It's the chance for the theater owner to still kick the show out of there and put a show in there that somebody or the audiences might like more. However, what's strange about this is it hit its stop clause, those 2 weeks where it was doing really badly early on, but now, months later, when it's doing really well, they're being kicked out for having done bad earlier.
Way long ago. I think it's so unfair. I'm like, I logically understand why they're being kicked out, because they went below their stop clause and the Schuberts have every right to kick them out. However, A, it is interesting that they invoked the stop clause so early in their run, because normally you kind of have a grace period because they don't have to enforce the stop clause. So you can fall below. But if the theater is like, you know, I think we're going to give you a few more months, see how it goes, see if it'll turn around, which is not uncommon. You know, they don't have to invoke it, but they did. And then in the article in the Times, the producers of Beetlejuice, which cost, what, $20 million or something?
I think it's right.
$21 million to produce, I think, were like, we will pay to move To Kill a Mockingbird, which is also in a Schubert theater, to a smaller theater so then Music Man can go into the Kill a Mockingbird theater. We'll pay for it all. And Scott Rudin was like, no. But to me, I'm like, well, if you're going to pay to move To Kill a Mockingbird, why don't you just pay to move your show to a new theater? And I think that they should go to a Niederlander theater.
My understanding, though, of that, why they don't want to move the show, is because of that $20 million, like a quarter of that was spent on the set, and the set was designed specifically for the Winter Garden, which has not totally unusual dimensions, but it's quite a wide theater, so it's not so easy to move this set that has puppets and effects built into it.
Yeah.
It probably costs more to move their show than it does to move something like To Kill a Mockingbird, which is a smaller scale play.
But also, I can't imagine the Music Man being open-ended, because it's Sutton Foster and Hugh Jackman, and Hugh Jackman isn't going to do a open-ended run on Broadway, you know?
I'm also not sure that Hugh Jackman will sell the tickets that Hugh Jackman used to sell.
Really? I think he will.
Well, we'll talk about it when the show opens.
We'll see what happens.
But my feeling is, you know, he did his solo one-man show, or the show that was built sort of all around him. And it did great, and was sold out, and everybody loved it, and it's like, oh man, Hugh Jackman is the money-making ticket. Then he did a couple other shows, including a play that we saw at Circle in the Square called The River or something. I don't remember. It was a play.
Yeah.
And it did not sell well. He was in it, two-person play. Maybe it was a three-person play.
I honestly don't remember. It sold very poorly.
And after seeing that, my sureness that he was a money-making thing diminished a little bit.
Yeah, but
granted, The Music Man's a musical.
Right. And it's like a revival. But I mean, that play was not good. It's not like, you know, it was good and he, you know, didn't sell it. It's like, that wasn't good. I think The Music Man, though, and you have Sutton Foster, who is now a name in her own right because of Younger and just being a Broadway star, even though you and I don't agree. I think there are Broadway stars. Josh doesn't think there are Broadway stars.
Idina Menzel might be the only real Broadway star.
We could have this argument for an hour.
Well, now's your chance to see Beetlejuice. I recommend it through June. It's a really good show, particularly if you just sort of like the more unusual, quirky comedy kind of stuff.
Just go and have a fun time. That's all, you know, it's not serious. It's just fun. And the singing is really good.
So on a slightly different topic, I just wanted to mention that Nell Gifford, who started the Gifford Circus, passed away this past week due to breast cancer. It's quite a sad story. The BBC covered it quite a good amount. But Nell started a touring circus that toured around the Cotswolds in England. Quite a popular show. I haven't had the chance to see it, but looking at photos and video footage of it, it looks very cool. Tweety, who's a clown that many people will know from Ringling, was the clown in it. I spoke to Jacob Astacio, who was a juggler in it this past year, who sort of talked about the experience of Nell performing while she was getting sicker and sicker. And it just sounded like an amazing thing to be part of, and very sad that this person has passed away. So thoughts go out to her and her family and those of you who know the Gifford Circus. And if you have the chance to see it, the show will still be running next year without Nell. So we're definitely going to go try to support it when we go to the Cotswolds next year.
Yeah.
Another circus show to talk about, much more positive, is 42 Feet, which I just saw at the New Victory Theater by Cirque Mechanics. The founder of Cirque Mechanics, Chris Lashua, is our guest today. I'll talk briefly about what I thought about the show, but I don't want to give too much away because we're going to talk about it for the rest of the podcast. But Cirque Mechanics is this circus company that's existed since 2004. I first saw their show Birdhouse Factory back in 2008, also at the New Victory Theater. And they're very cool. They do a combination of contemporary and traditional circus and also do crazy stuff with set pieces that they build themselves. That's, I think, where the mechanics part of Cirque Mechanics comes into play. This show in particular, 42 Feet, was about traditional circus. And the coolest part about the set was that it was a circus ring that over the circus ring was sort of this arch where they could hang any kind of circus equipment they wanted, but the whole ring could turn, which I know is probably sounds kind of weird just listening to it for that podcast. I encourage you to Google it. But what it allowed the show to do was to either be in the ring and be on stage, or if they turned the ring all the way around, they could give the appearance of what goes on backstage at the circus.
What is hilarious, we told Chris this, is Josh and Book Kennison and Eric Allen had this idea of kind of like a turning stage. You could see like the backstage and the front stage forever. And then
I saw someone do it.
He saw someone do it. And I guess like what Chris was saying kind of off the podcast about it was that, you know, you always have all these ideas going into a show. He's like, I had all these ideas about the back lot showing. And then, you know, you get like to three or four of the ideas in. But I was like, well, then maybe we can try again, you know. So just got that bar. So, I mean, I think like it's clearly like a good idea and an interesting topic to explore.
It really was. And it just gave a lot of moments for interesting visual imagery of people walking off stage, walking on stage. And for those who are circus performers, there's just these great moments that you recognize from your own life, you know, in the back lot or backstage, portrayed in this fun, family-friendly way by Cirque Mechanics. So we won't go too much into it, as we're going to talk about it quite a bunch. But before we do that, I want to talk about our sponsor, Circus Talk, the online circus community's place for jobs, news, and event information. I want to point out a few things from this past week. Under the jobs section, Sanka, which is a circus organization based in Seattle, is looking for a new social circus director. If you're West Coast based, that might be a good position for you. Codarts, which is the circus school in Holland, in the Netherlands, is currently accepting applications. So if you are interested in that circus school, now's your time to apply. Under the events section, Cirque Us is doing their annual fundraiser, winter fundraiser. It's on December 20th. You can find more information about that on their website. Another interesting event, NECA, the New England Circus Center for the Arts. A bunch of those people have been on our podcast in the past, are doing an open house of their amazing training space in Vermont on January 4th. If you've not yet seen it and you're curious, I think this is probably the best circus space that exists on the East Coast. It was custom built. And on January 4th, you get to go walk around it and see all the cool facilities.
That's so fun.
Right?
Yeah.
If we were available, I'd definitely go to that.
Yeah.
In the news, Treasure Island's owner, Treasure Island is a casino in Las Vegas. The owner also owns Circus Circus, and they're in talks with Cirque du Soleil to put the Illusionists inside Circus Circus. It's a pretty interesting article about whether or not that's a good or a bad idea and how well Cirque is or isn't selling in Vegas. The Illusionists is a company that Cirque du Soleil bought as part of their expansion. We talked about that a little bit with Daniel Lamar on his episode. But to learn more about those news, those jobs and events, visit circustalk.com.
You know, Treasure Island used to have this really cool, like, pirate water show outside that you could just walk up on the sidewalk and watch. And I vividly remember watching it when I was little, and now it doesn't exist anymore.
They nixed it.
So sad. It was so fun. It's in a movie. Oh, Miss Congeniality.
Two.
Miss Congeniality 2. It was so good. I loved it. But anyway, Treasure Island, bring it back. So on today's podcast, like we mentioned a few times, we have Chris Lashua, who I could have kept talking to him for another at least hour. I was really interested by what he was saying, so I think it's a really fun podcast to listen to. He just has such a different background and upbringing in the circus than most circus performers nowadays. You know, he came from like a very different genre of performance than circus, and he just like is kind of one of those OG circ performers that learned through doing, and I always am enamored by people like that.
One thing about Chris to know is that most people know Chris that he started Cirque Mechanics, but he's also the German wheel performer in the videotaped version of Kidam. So for those of you who've watched Kidam either in person or on video, like I have way too many times, he's the guy who did the German wheel act with the bowler hat and the gloves.
And if you haven't seen it, before you listen to this podcast or after,
YouTube it,
because it's definitely worth seeing. And, you know, I mentioned this on the podcast, but most German Wheel that I see on Instagram nowadays is just like linear. It just goes through, you know, on a one line. And his act is so dynamic and interesting. And you know, it's really good. You should definitely watch it. I think you're going to really enjoy this podcast. Before the interview, here's our ask. Please subscribe on iTunes. Rate us on iTunes. Follow us on Instagram, Twitter, tweet us, or email us at hello@hadawaycircus.com.
And don't forget, get your tickets to our upcoming off-Broadway show, Beyond Babel, opens January 21st in New York City. Use the code PODCAST at checkout for 15% off.
Here is our interview with Chris.
Chris, thank you for coming over. The first question we usually ask everybody is, where are you from originally?
I'm from a little town about an hour northwest of Boston.
Where? I'm from Boston.
Yeah, I'm from, it's north of Fitchburg, a little town called Ashburnham.
Okay, if I'm southwest.
If you ever went skiing, you drove right by my house on Main Street.
Yes.
When you're going up to like Okemo.
Uh-huh, I definitely skied at Okemo.
There you go.
Uh-huh, amazing. There's something about being from Boston or like Massachusetts, I think, that bonds people.
I've been in Vegas now for 20 years. I couldn't agree more. When you meet somebody that's from New England, you just know right away.
Yeah.
Or you're clicking really well and you're wow. And then wait a minute. Yeah. And it all makes sense.
Yes.
Did you see many circus shows coming through, you know, your area?
So when I was a kid, my parents would bring me to the big ones, you know, like we'd go to see Ringling at the time it was Boston Garden.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember being like, my earliest memories being, I don't know, maybe 10 years old or something like that. And like, looking at, and I was probably like, we were probably way up in the balcony or something, and we're looking and there's color and everything's like, I don't know, gold, right? And there's streamers and there's elephants, there's all these big wagons, and then the lights go out and they come back up, and you know, it was probably 30 seconds, but it felt like 5 seconds, and then everything was pink or whatever, you know. And I remember the scale and the spectacle was, you know, pretty cool. But as I started to get more into circus, I definitely felt a little bit more akin to the smaller stuff, the smaller things that you know, kind of a one ring format.
Mm-hmm.
So when I saw Big Apple so many years later, you know, that felt like, wow, that's a really cool, mm-hmm. that's a great scale, good, you know, I mean, still traditional. But my first introduction was actually through Ringling Brothers. I met one of the casting guys, named Tim Holst. He was looking for somebody to go to China for a festival. And I was doing my BMX thing. That's how I, you know, I went to university for marketing and advertising, and paid for that with my BMX.
Where'd you go? Wait, so back up. We have to go back. Yeah, he was like, jump so much.
So the BMX thing. So you just like riding bikes around your town? Is that how you got it? Is that the original way it happened?
So early on, and this is like, you know, early in the 80s, I was doing BMX, and I saw a guy from the West Coast come in, and he did a show at the Bayside Expo Center in Boston.
Mm-hmm.
And that show, funny enough, like, you know, 30 years later, we talked to all these guys who kind of rose up and went into the X Games or sports. And so many of these guys were at that show. So I decided then I'm going to do this BMX thing. And this,
so you were just riding bikes. Is that how you just, yeah, is that how you get into BMX?
Yeah. Well, it was, so BMX was motocross, but then there was this whole thing called freestyle BMX, which is like the ramps and the skate mm-hmm. parks and all that stuff. And so we built our own ramps and started doing tricks, and I joined a team that was doing exhibitions all over New England. And
how old are you at this time?
This time I was probably 16.
Okay.
And then I joined that team, and we got a sponsorship by Mountain Dew and GT Bicycles in California. Started doing national work with them, and then going to national competitions, picked up bigger sponsors, and then getting covered in the magazines. And so we would be, there was 10 or 12 of us that were in the professional category. So we'd go to all over the country and do shows and expos.
What is like the competition? What do you have to do in a competition? I don't know anything about
this world. Yeah, it's so, it's evolved a little bit. I mean, if anybody's seen what's on the X Games, it's kind of a steroid version of what it was. There was things called Flatland, which is like a, kind of like a floor routine,
uh-huh.
right?
Which they have in Cirque still, right?
Some they do.
Flatland bike.
Exactly. Mm. And now they have a vert thing like in Volta. They've got like ramps yep. and people flipping and doing all that stuff. So back in the day, you didn't really specialize. You just did everything, right? So you would do the ground stuff and the ramp stuff. So that was my thing. And that was my introduction really to circus as an artist was, I got to go to Wu Chow for Ringling, to do my BMX act.
And so crazy that Tim Holst was the person who cast you, who passed away a couple of years ago, but he's like the OG of Ringling casting.
And he was, yeah. And like, I had no idea, right? It was a friend of mine who introduced me to him. He comes to Boston. He says, hey, I would love to have you and your partner come do this thing in China. I want to come and see what you're doing. You know, we'll up with the routine. He came. He was super hands-on. Like, that's we cool. were doing shows. Like, we weren't we weren't just, like, you know, like, surfer dude kind of guys. Yeah. Kind of being like, yeah, we're going to do some stuff in the parking lot. We were, we approached it like a show. We had a sound system, and we had an MC, and
cool. you know,
music, and we choreographed the routines. And so we were kind of a step ahead of where I think he thought we were going to be, because mm-hmm. I think we were just going to be street punks, you know, and he was going to have to do a lot. He gave us some input, you know, helped us out with it. And then we went to China, and that's where I met one of the founders of Cirque. I met Gilles Saint-Croix there, one of the founders of Cirque du Soleil. And he kind of took me under his wing while I was there, because I didn't know anything about circus. And I hung out with him and the artist that was there. And her name was Rebecca Perez. She's a trapeze artist that they had at the festival. And then I went back to Boston. I went back to interning at an ad agency.
Wow. So this is, how old are you now when you go to
circus? This was now I was 20.
So you took some time off of school?
No, I finished school.
You finished, yeah, so where'd you go to school?
So I went to Boston University.
BU?
Yeah.
To do marketing, you said?
Marketing and advertising. Okay.
Is that like a real come down after, like, you know, traveling?
You know what? Like, I kept traveling. So I was competing, like, through BU. Like, it was one semester I actually took. I went, like, half part-time for a semester. And that was dangerous because, like, if you're not doing it all the time, it's really easy to be like, I'll be fine, you know? Yeah. And I was riding for Mongoose at the time. This is before Mongoose sold out to a Chinese company, and they still were all American made, and it was, you know, like, still a really big brand in BMX. And they were paying me to go away, like, pretty much every weekend and do shows and go on tour in the summertime. So that's how I paid for school.
Oh, cool.
So I was still doing it. And then I'd do the school thing and during the week, and then I'd go away, and then I'd come back, and it worked. But yeah, I didn't have a traditional kind of college experience where I just, like, stayed there. I was gone all the time, you know.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was probably more like 21, cause I had just graduated, and I was trying to get a job as an ad intern, you know, advertising, you know, and I got this opportunity, and I talked to the guy at the ad agency, and I was like, hey, I got this opportunity to do this thing. And I thought he'd be like, what do you mean? Like, I need you to, like, you know, paste stuff up on this mock up in the back. And I tell him what it is. And he's like, wait a minute. He's like, you know, he was probably in his 50s. Like, wait a minute, you can join this. You get a chance to join the circus. Get the hell out of here. If you like it, you know, great. If it doesn't work, I'll come back. I'll hire you, you know.
That's so nice.
So I went and took off, and I kind of never came back.
So which circus was that job offer for?
So that was for a project. So Cirque du Soleil. So went to the festival, met Gilles, and then I got back to Boston, and I was like, okay, I'm going to come back and do my ad thing, you know. Well, that was cool, you know. And then he when I was there, he said, hey, you know, we have this show called Nouvelle Experience. It's on HBO this month. You should check it out. I had no idea who they were, right? So I get back, and like, somebody had HBO, like, not like now where everybody has cable. But that, so I like, find it, and I watch Nouvelle X, and I was like, my head was like, whoa. Like, I had no concept of New Circus at all, really, you know? So I was blown away. And then he called me like a week later. He said, hey, we got this project. It's in Japan. It's next summer. This is like in November or something like that, or maybe February. Yeah, November, December. He says, hey, we get this project next summer in Japan. That's the first time we've been there. We're doing 6 months over there with a show. It's going to be called Fascination. Basically, it was a mix of, like, Nouvelle Experiences, which were one of their shows that was mm-hmm. touring at the time. They were in Battery Park, like, that around that time. And then a previous show, Cirque Reinventé, which was this bright, more fantastical kind of show. Nouvelle X was really dark, and mm-hmm. and the other show was really bright. Well, apparently the Japanese producer had seen the bright and cheery one, and now Cirque's touring this darker one with these artists. And the Japanese producer was like, no way, that's too dark for Japan. They wanted something. They wanted this kind of bubblegum kind of thing. And Cirque made some concessions and made a mashup of a show they call Fascination, which they don't really ever talk about.
No, I don't think I've ever heard
it. It was great. And you know what? It was a good show. All the acts were fantastic. They were straight out of Nouvelle Experience. So I met all these people, and they were going to Vegas after that contract. Ooh. And I was in Boston. All these guys are based in Montreal. So we finished our gig in Japan. I had the time of my life. And I went back to the ad world after that. And I was like, oh, wow. Okay, you know, like, it's over, because they didn't have any spots for BMX at the time in their shows, right? Mm. So all my friends were going to Vegas, and they were coming through Vegas like a month after that tour finished to go to set up for Nouvelle Experience at the Mirage, which mm-hmm. was a test run they did for a year behind the Mirage. And this is in a tent behind the Mirage, right? Where all the villas are. It's all built up now. You know, I think that's where Secret Garden is or something now. I don't know. So this was this big test to see if Cirque du Soleil would actually take hold in Vegas. Wow. So all of my friends were coming through Boston. They were driving across the country. And they're like, hey, you should, you know, we're going to come see you. Come with us, you know, road trip. And I was like, you guys are crazy, man. I got a job, you know. And they convinced me to jump in the car with them. And just for a couple of days, just come to Memphis. Or just, you know, you can take a bus back. And I was like, okay, you know. Before I know it, we're at the Grand Canyon. We're camping at the Grand Canyon. And then we're in Vegas. And they're like, hey, you know, next week is the premiere of Salt and Bacca, which was another touring show they had. We're all going to go to the premiere. You should hang out till next week and we're all going to go. It's going to be great. So I stayed. And then we're like, you know, we're going to set up trapeze. Flying Trapeze is going to be set up next week. And I was playing around all summer on Flying Trapeze with my friends, the French troupe that was there. And you got to stick around. We're going to do trapeze. And I was like, okay, I'll stick around another week, you know. And I was crashing on people's couches and floors. And then like a week after that, they were like, hey, man, opening is next week. You can't leave now. It's going to be a great party. It's going to be amazing, you know. So I stayed, and then like right before it opened, there was a costume, lead costume person, wardrobe person from Japan. She's like, hey, Chris, I know you're here for the opening, but I had to just fire my dresser and I need somebody to just dress the still characters. Would you, like, I know you want to just see the show, but would you mind working for a couple of shows? And I was like, okay, you know, so suddenly I'm like laundry guy and I'm dressing still characters. And then I worked my way, pretty quickly I was assistant to the backstage manager doing cues and opening the curtain and running fog machines. And then because I was setting up trapeze every day and a good friend of mine, Mickey Dewhurst, was a tight wire artist. So I'd be in there setting up the wire with him, setting the trapeze up to help. I knew all the rigging cues. And then like within a month or two, a buddy of mine who was a rigger got a motorcycle accident, hurt his shoulder, and they needed a rigger. So they were like, hey, you know all the cues already.
Oh my God.
Bam, suddenly I'm a rigger on the show. And then I still wanted to perform though, you know?
Yeah.
So I was looking around. A buddy of mine on the show showed me a picture of a friend of his, this guy named Yacinth Reich. I hope I'm saying it right. Because he kind of set me off on a path that led me to where I am now. It was a guy who was doing an act in a wheel, which is, you know, we know now as a German wheel. And he had built his own as this funny shaped wheel, funny size wheel. And of course, I reached out to him through Didier. Hey, well, you know, I'm thinking about doing this wheel thing. And I got silence from this guy. Because he's like, look, I created this thing.
Like,
you know,
you
like,
want to do
we
this
all, as a circus artist, we know what this is now. When you're on the other side of it, you're like, oh, you want to do my thing?
Yeah.
What? And you want me to tell you how to do it? Right. So I just like, okay, fine. Like, I looked at this photograph and I'm like, well, okay, I know it's a hoop. I know that, you know, from his knee to his ankle is, you know, mine's about 18 inches. So I'm guessing that hoop's about 6 feet tall. I had nothing, you know? So I fabricated one in Vegas while I was a stagehand.
You made it.
Built it.
Wow.
Yeah.
Did you have any like welding experience before?
No, and my welding was terrible. So the guys in the shop ended up welding it for me. But everything was like, I didn't even know what I was doing. I just built this wheel. Started playing around with it. Brought it into at this time now, this was the end of Nouvelle Experience. And they moved me over to Mystère as a rigger because they didn't have a spot for me anywhere else. And I built this wheel and I bring it in there. And all my circus friends were like, hey, I saw a guy do a thing like this. And you should try this. And so I had all these coaches that were amazing in all these other universes, but don't know anything about German wheel, helping me to figure it out.
Yeah.
So we figured it out together. So I'd be in there at like 3 o'clock in the morning, rolling around on stage.
It probably created like a really cool looking act though. Cause I think like the one bad thing about all the ability to see videos is everyone's act kind of feels similar.
Exactly. I mean, I think it's a good thing to talk about because so I had nothing. There was no video. There was no YouTube. Right. None of that, right? So you got this prop, and you basically just go like, okay, this is complete exploration. I'm going to dive in. I'm just going to research all this stuff, right? And the danger now is that you can't not see the video first, right? That's usually how people are introduced to pieces, right? So you see a video, and immediately you're set off on a path of copying what you saw.
Right.
You can't help yourself. It's like, right. I want to try to do that thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's fine. And yes, you can progress quickly to a point, but then you have an appreciation and an understanding for how to do that move. But you really haven't done your homework and done the research and put in the blood, sweat, tears, time, falling, smacking yourself on the ground, all those things that are necessary to really completely understand the apparatus,
mm-hmm.
which is a challenge in circus. The way it happens now is people will see something, they'll go and then they'll go to some gym and they'll have a teacher who is probably not even really the place they should be teaching anybody, show them some stuff, and then they get in over their heads, and then they have a certain understanding of the piece, but it's limited by what their coach was. And It's a bit of a challenge. Yeah.
It's a good explanation of circus in New York, generally speaking.
It's a challenge, yeah.
So
yeah.
Were you the German, the person in the German Wheel Act in the video of Kidam?
Yeah, that was me, yeah.
So I probably watched that video of Kidam and your act in particular between like 9 and 14 more than any other circus DVD. I feel like I can imagine your costume and makeup like that.
It's a pretty cool thing. Like, I mean, to this day I hear from people that are like, you know, that are... like that I look at as like contemporaries that are, you know, 10, 15 years younger than me. I'm like, oh my God, I burned that DVD up. You know, I played the heck out of that. The guy that actually got the job when I, you know, and I did that for about 5 years with Cirque du Soleil off and on. And the guy that they gave the contract to after a couple of replacements later was a kid who saw me in Santa Monica. He was like 10 years old. Went with his dad and he said, I want to do that.
Right? Wow.
And he you know, trained and he was one person. So now I'm on the other side of this thing. I'm doing Wheel. I had figured it out with my friends and did a lot of it. And honestly, it was about, I was about 6 months into training on this thing before Cirque du Soleil was like, you know, coming on. Gilles would come to Mysterio and be like, oh, you're working on this thing. Oh, you know, and I was like, I was so like, I wanted to show them this because I knew it.
Because you're never still rigging at this point.
Yeah.
Okay.
And Wheel hadn't been in any of their shows. So I was like, okay, like, I gotta show them. I gotta show them and I gotta be the guy, right? So I show Jill and he's like, oh, you know what? This is really cool. Yeah, we were thinking about that. And then I see him like a month later, he's like, oh, we found a guy in Germany, he's great. And I was like, what?
No.
He's like, yeah, he's amazing. He's like, yeah, you know, I'll show you, I'll get to video, you know, and he gives me this video tape, you know, and VCR, a cassette.
VHS.
A VHS tape, right?
It's sad when people don't know that anymore. I'm like, oh no.
So, and I'm like, and I run home and I plug this thing in and my mind is like, whoa, like this whole universe. And of course, since they've been doing German Wheel, they call it Rundrad, for like since the 20s and the 30s in Germany and as a, you know, as almost Olympic level kind of competitive sport.
Oh, wow.
So there's all this vocabulary and all this stuff, which I didn't know. And there's all these rules, which I didn't know, which, as you mentioned earlier, was the greatest thing for me because I approached this like I did my BMX stuff. So it was a, and it created an act that was much more street, much more urban, much more flowy, akin to snowboarding and skating and BMX and not sport and gymnastic, right? Because the video of the act that he showed me, this guy Wolfgang, who ended up being my coach, only because he didn't know who Cirque du Soleil was and turned down the gig when they offered it to him.
Oh, wow.
So aside from being a little bit, you know, upset in the beginning, when they finally came around and said, so we have a suggestion. We're going to actually have you train to this guy. And I was like,
great.
Anyway, right. Let's do it. Which was the best because I had been working for now, like, I don't know, 8 months or maybe it was even longer than that, drilling everything I could on the wheel, finding stuff that I could do. And when I went to train with him, they looked at me like I was an alien. I had made these straps for my feet to lock my feet in so I could, like, not fall out of the wheel. And I go there and the wheels are all like, it's like buying skis. It's like, how tall are you? Oh, you're 5'10". Oh, you need a 2-meter 10 wheel. And I'd be like, oh.
I just made this.
I don't know, right? And the handles are in different positions and the feet, they've got these belts that you got to buckle your feet into. And I was like, what is that? So I'm there with my wheel in this gym with like 20 kids that are 10 years old rolling back and forth in lines with their coach and a bunch of like people doing this crazy stuff. This is now that they've got me in Germany training. And I'd never, I was like, what, where am I? Right. I walk in this gym, there's 20 wheels. I've never seen one before. So I'm playing with my wheel that I'd brought. And I do this thing where I jump out of it and I spin it around and I jump back in and I slide my feet in and I keep going. And they're looking at me like, whoa, what was that? And so what I didn't really understand, I saw it on their video, was that they would have to bend down and adjust their feet in, right?
Wow.
And I'm like, and so they'd be like, why do you have these seatbelt straps sewn onto the thing that are sticking up? I'm like, well, so I can jump in and go.
Right.
And then spin around, jump out and go back in it. Right. And they'd be like, oh, you can see them like, oh, like a light bulb. Right?
Right.
And because they had been trained that this is a sport like gymnastics, it's like what I had done was akin to putting a third handle on a pommel horse. Like you just don't do that.
Right. Because they had just,
it's set, this is how it is. That's it. Right. And there are rules.
Especially in Germany. This is how it is.
It's very, very formal.
His dad's German.
Yeah.
Okay. I know how it is.
So it's super formal and you don't mess with it. And yet, like, you could see them, like, especially the younger people going like, whoa, that's interesting.
Yeah.
So they had me buy a wheel from the main guy. His name is Holger Zimmermann. He's since passed. His son now is No, Oswald was a dad. His son Holger. So anybody that has a German wheel or bought a German wheel or a steel wheel from Germany, it's likely a Zimmermann wheel.
Okay.
So I go to this guy's shop and Cirque was like, you got to have this big wheel because it's the way you have to do it, you know. And okay, fine. So I go to this guy's shop and I explain to him what I wanted. I want these little plaques on each side so I can put a strap on. Mm-hmm. And he goes, oh, and scratches his head. He goes, oh. Okay, so he welds this thing on. And I put my straps on, and that wheel becomes the wheel I use in Kidam, and it's the wheel that's seen by a lot of people. Well, then, apparently, Holger and Oswald start getting requests for German wheels.
With the...
Well, they don't know. What happens is they send some wheels, and the people are like, wait, that's not the wheel I saw.
Oh.
So then he starts putting these brackets on, and he calls it the American system.
Right?
Which is crazy, and I didn't know until, like... 10 years later, I go to buy another wheel.
Yeah.
And he's like, oh, Chris, yeah. You want the American system? I was like, American system? He said, yeah, with the brackets on the side for the bindings. And I was like, American system?
You mean my system? The Chris system?
I was like, yeah, I guess I want the American system. Anyway, Kidam, of course, was a fantastic show. And it was like, for me, I mean, absolutely a highlight. I got to do... I had to work with the most amazing people, and the director and the creative team was the masters, you know, Debbie Brown and Franco Dragone and Luke LaFortune on lighting. And it was absolutely an amazing experience. And they had a certain synergy that team did. And many of those early shows, there was a kind of shorthand they had in that creation process. And it was great to be part of.
So one quick question about just German wheel as a discipline. It seems like a huge pain in the butt if you were to pick that as your main thing, because when you break it down, it breaks down into these huge pieces that are a pain in the butt to move. And because it takes up so much floor space to do.
But before you answer that, I think just for some people who don't know what German wheel is, maybe explain German wheel.
Yeah, so German wheel, it is like if you took a ladder... and you bent that into a circle and connected the ends. So it's two hoops that are parallel to each other.
That's a good way to explain
connected
it.
Connected by eight rungs. And two of those rungs back in the day, and now there's people build them every which way, but back in the day there were these two wooden boards you put your feet on, two handles up above, and the image is much like the Da Vinci drawing of it's called the Vitruvian Man. Everybody's seen it. It's that image that's used by, you know, physical therapy clinics and medicine everywhere with a guy standing there with his arms up in a wheel. So it looks like that, and then you manipulate it, you drop it down like a coin, and you stay inside it, you spin around, and it operates in some ways like a set of rolling parallel bars, so you can do lots of P-bar stuff, so hip circles, handstands, all this stuff that you might be able to do on parallel bars, but it's a rolling apparatus. In terms of being practical, it's not practical, which is why the single wheel or steer wheel has become so much more popular, because A, it's cheaper to buy. B, you can do it in a very small area. And yes, it breaks down even smaller. But to speak to that and to go a step further about fabrication, they used to make German wheels only to break into four pieces. And after doing this for years with Cirque and going to do gigs and breaking down four pieces and going on planes, which I used to do.
But you
couldn't
check
do
it
now. You check it. Yeah,
oh,
you
wow.
couldn't do it now. But I would check it in two different pieces. And then I went back to him to buy a new wheel. And I was like, hey, I'd like this into six pieces. He's like, no, we can't do that. Really? Because seems like you could do it. He's like, no. And he agreed to break it. He's like, I'll do five pieces. I'm like, okay, five pieces. That means now when it's broken down, at least it's like 3 feet long instead of like 5 feet long or 6 feet long. So he did a five-piece wheel. And then like a year later, I went back to him and was like, I want a six-piece wheel. And he's like, okay. So he made me a six-piece wheel. And now he sells them in different sizes like that because you can travel with them easier.
For sure.
Yeah.
We were talking about Spiegel World a little bit earlier, but they had a German wheel act in one of those shows. This guy Yasu.
Yasu's great.
And amazing.
Yeah.
But I had to carry his German wheel like all around Midtown just like during that creation. I was like, oh my God, I'm so happy I never picked German wheels. Yeah. But I'd be lugging this everywhere.
It's not, you know what though? That's, I mean, in some ways, and this is something for people that are looking into circus, a surefire way to be putting yourself in the mix of competing with everybody is to pick those things that are easier.
Easy.
And are practical. I mean, the nice thing about German wheel right now is that if you're good at it, you're going to get work because nobody's doing it anymore. Mm-hmm. It's gotten super rare. And
the people I see doing it on Instagram, of course, Instagram, yeah. are like like you said, athletic gymnast, sport.
It's a lot of sports stuff.
In Jim Will. And they do some cool stuff. I'm like, oh, that's a cool little like line.
Yeah.
How long is it the like ideal length?
Yeah. So back in the day when I was, you know, on the kind of the top of my game, I could do the full act in a 24x16, which is small.
Yeah,
Full revolution for the wheel, because it's 7 feet tall, right? And you know that. You know, if you roll that 7 feet along the circumference of that wheel, means that you need at least 21 feet. And it's a little more than that. And then you're going to rock back and forth a little bit. So you really need closer to 30 feet to be able to have a full revolution and then rock on both sides. So I would ask for like 32 feet, whatever, whenever he was doing gigs, and they'd be like, yeah. And you'd get there and it'd be like 20 and be like, still needs space to roll. Right. So you'd get half a revolution in and do some coin stuff. And so you need a fair amount of space for it.
Yeah.
And as you said, it's not practical. But in terms of circus in general, like now, you know, I'm fast forward all these years, and we build our own shows, and we're trying to do shows and add acts to the mix that are less known.
Mm-hmm. And the ladder act from last night.
Yeah, so the ladder is a good example. So ladder is something that, and here's a good, and I'll touch back on the whole creation process about video. So ladder, we have a revolving ladder, and it's essentially a 14-foot steel ladder that I made in the fabrication shop. And I did it kind of quickly as a prototype, and then it worked. And so
it worked.
So it's in the show, right? So it's 14 feet long, and it rotates on its central axis. And that crane bar, that axis of rotation is about, I don't know, that's probably 10 feet off the floor. So back in the day, this was done as a traditional circus act, was done like way up in the air, you know, and it was done more in a lyrical way. They'd have like a girl hanging from a trapeze on one end and her husband on the other end. And they would do like a lot of balancing, and they would do some revolves, but it was like much more of a big scale thrill spec kind of act. Mm-hmm. So never seen it done in a dynamic way.
You turned it into a very German wheelie.
There's a bit about the creation about that. So I will tell you something, though. I started to do research, right? I'm looking. And so I'm online looking, and I'm trying to find like old videos. And this newer video pops up, and I'm going to mess his name. You might know him. Chris Peterson? I think it's Chris. If I got it wrong, I'm sorry, Chris. He was in, I think he was in Iris for a bit. He's in Europe. And he's doing an acular revolving ladder with a partner, and it's dynamic. And so I'm scrolling through, and I see this act, and I watch the video, and I'm like, whoa. And then I stopped myself, and I watched it through, and then I was done, and I forced myself to not watch it again, and it was really hard.
Yeah.
Because like there's so much you want to learn, so much you want to get, but I remember that whole thing of like, I'm like, no. And when I built it. I also didn't want to be limited on the construction. I knew. You know, we know what a ladder looks like, but I also knew from German Wheel that if I could remove a couple of these rungs, I could do German Wheel moves. Mm. I could sit on it and do the sit revolve, which you saw in the show. I could do hip circles. I could do a lot of the stuff that I used to physically do, and, you know, harder for me to do now.
And sort of while it feels like Wheel of Death.
Right.
You're talking about wheels as well. It's also exactly. That moment of like the lightness
the flight
at the
over
top
the top
and the speed going down.
Yeah. And so, it's dynamic and I told this to the artist, like, so I started playing around with it. It was a girl that I wanted to bring into the show. So it was myself and her, and her name is Kay Henning. And she did the first season of 42 Feet with us. And so we did all the research kind of together on this thing, you know, figuring it out. Like, mm-hmm. I'm heavier, she's lighter, but her end of the ladder's heavier because there's more rungs on it. Mine's lighter. Mm-hmm. So we got struck this balance. And again, we didn't know, there's no like rule book with this stuff. And that's the thing I would really express to people that are starting off in circus. It's like, there should be no rule. I mean, that's the whole point, right?
I think that's
why we're doing this.
Right. That's the only trouble with going to circus school.
Yeah.
It's like, here's this move, and then this move connects to this move.
Here's what's done before. Right. So we were looking at – so I actually encouraged them. When we started playing, I was like, look, you're going to be tempted to go, like, watch a bunch of videos. Like, and I'm not going to say don't watch the video, but, like here's what I think.
Yeah.
And so I said that, and I was like, look, like, I think we can easily get in the trap – of like wanting to learn that move.
Yeah.
And then you're learning that move, but you're not really doing the homework that'll get you to that move. You're going to get to that move eventually, likely, if you really spend enough time with the apparatus, right? So we started playing around with it and adding people to it. And then you take all the related vocabulary from other devices, German wheel, like you said. The width of that ladder is exactly related to my German wheel, because I was like, look, I want to build this thing so we can do that vocabulary. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the things that I think that where we, that works for us is that, you know, I build this stuff. I don't, mm-hmm. you know, my welding is horrible. So we have a great, we have great fabrication partners in Vegas that do all the welding. But I get to, I cut the metal, I drill it, I bend it, I roll it, I shape it. And then I put it on the table and I clamp it and then the welders make it beautiful. And they make it safe. Mm-hmm. But because I'm involved in the, from the napkin drawing to the stage, we build stuff that like the artists are involved, like from stage one, mm-hmm. right? Instead of like, you know, sometimes when things get built and then they, the organization will hand this off to the artist to be like,
here. Figure it out. Right.
Like, well, that's cool. But you know, if you had made that bar an inch around, I could have done giants on it or I could have done something else, but you made it 2 inches around. How am I going to grab it? Like, so we sidestep a lot of that stuff and that helps that. And as a result of that, pretty much when we build everything now, we're, you know, we're artists that are building this stuff. We're not fabricators that are building this stuff. We're artists, you know? So in some ways that's why many of the, we've had success with a lot of the things that we've built. And plenty of failures too. Those things don't end up on stage. You don't see those. So
I do want to, I have a few questions about 42 feet, sure. but I first want to ask how Cirque Mechanics got started.
Yeah. So, it's actually, I was on Kidam and I was in Europe and I was looking for a way to do German wheel in a smaller space. We just talked about that, right? I'm like, okay, well, this is a real impediment to being able to work. I need to be able to work in a small space. So I built a set of rollers, with the help of the technical team there. And I put these rollers on a little cart and I put that cart on wheels. So now I have this cart that can roll back and forth with these rollers on it. I put my wheel on it and I could spin in place, much like,
oh, cool.
much like riding on rollers in, you know, like, I don't know, Peloton or like a, you know, exercise bike. Like that. But I'm in my German wheel spinning around like a guy in a hamster. And, I put some cranks and levers on that thing, which would allow me to engage the drive wheels on the floor with the rollers. So I could click this lever in place. And then when I spin in the German wheel, it would drive this cart across the stage. This became what is the trolley and the center point of Birdhouse Factory, which is our first show and the way we got Cirque Mechanics started. So I built this contraption and I was playing with it and I got great feedback. I mean, the artists that I was working with, they're doing the same show day in and day out. And so they're hungry to explore and experiment. And so if you can, if you have the energy when you're on these shows and in a contract like that, if you can get have the energy and time to just work on something, you got the greatest resources. I had all these people and all this talent who were like ready and hungry to develop content and play. So from the fabricators and the technicians to the other artists. And so I teamed up with a friend of mine, Aloysia Gavre, who's now been my lifelong kind of creative partner, co-director of all our shows and mm-hmm. choreographer. And she runs a Cirque school in LA and fantastically creative. And she's an aerialist at the time. And so I connected a winch to the trolley and I would spin in my wheel and that winch would lift her up and down.
Oh,
so you have this image on one side of me spinning in a German wheel with a cable that goes up over down to that aerialist being lifted. So you have this clunky, heavy machine with levers and cranks and chains that are visible, right? Mm-hmm. That's the key too. That we want to see this. Like, I want to see this. And then the cable that connects to this lyrical thing is happening over here. And these things become part of the same image. That idea is really that's like the seed of what we wanted to do. So Aloysia and I kept working. We would find time and the riggers would help us like late at night. We'd connect our whole thing up and make it happen. And that project, I got really excited and I was, you know, kind of, I'd done 2000 shows or something doing German wheel. I was like, okay, I'm going to do something else. I went back to Vegas and I got a job as a technician because I needed to, you know, work. And luckily for me, I had the support of a lot of the Cirque du Soleil creative people and they let me actually have my trolley at Mystère. We'd hang it from the grid and bring it down late at night and I'd play with it. And Aloysia and I kept working. She was still at Cirque at the time. She'd come back, we'd do projects. And then she left and she called me one day and said, hey, Gypsy Snyder from the Seven Fingers, Les Sept-Doigts, who I know you've had on the podcast before. Gypsy and Aloysia are lifelong friends. They grew up together, Pickle Family
and
Circus.
And Gypsy literally can be connected to almost
everybody.
It is crazy.
And it's absolutely incredible.
Yeah, because she was one of our very early guests. And then everyone else is like everyone at least once says, and then Gypsy.
Oh, there's a connection.
Oh, yeah.
There's like one degree of separation.
Yeah, it's Gypsy. Like Kevin Bacon. Yeah. Gypsy's out of
Circus,
like,
well, she is. So she, they had had, they had had their show, their first show, which became known as Loft. And I think at the time it was still just called Seven Fingers. As part of the end of the year circus show for the Circus Center of San Francisco. And so the Circus Center of San Francisco had brought them in, and they would do like a show with their end of the year show for their artists, but they brought in the Seven Fingers to do this show, and they just slayed it. I mean, you know, people were like blown away, and it was an amazing show, and it was really successful, both like artistically, and they sold a bunch of tickets, and it was the greatest fundraiser they ever had. And so they wanted to replicate that the next year, and they got a hold of Gypsy and said, "Hey, we'd like you back to do it again." And she's like, "Ah, I'm doing this other thing. I can't do it, or the timing isn't right, or whatever that is." And she said, "But my friend, you know, my really good friend Aloysia is doing work with her friend Chris, and I think they have something cool, and you know, maybe they're interested." So the Circus Center called Aloysia, and she knew the people there because she was from San Francisco and had been through that building and through those coaches and worked with all those people. And she explained, "Hey, yeah, I've got this project I'm working on with Chris. You know, maybe he'd be interested." So I got a call. She said, "Hey, would you be interested in doing, you know, the machine stuff? You know, at the time we were calling it Mechanical Action, you know." And they were like, "You know, would you be interested?" And I'm like, "Of course, you know, let's go." So I flew to San Francisco and I did a pitch of this show. And we had made like a little demo video of like the wheel, and I built another machine, which became the spin cycle. It's basically a portable pedal driven turntable device. Yeah, that's called the spin cycle. Yeah, and that was in our show, Birdhouse. We had it in Pedal Punk as well. So we had that on the video, and we did this video, and Rex's Aloysia's partner, Rex, he came and did video for that, and we had these artists, and I had the lighting guy at Mystère, who like literally opened up the back door and like got all these lights and said, "Here, just bring them back, but be back in the morning, but whatever." I'm not gonna tell you his name, but So again, the support of the circus community who like really just want to like, you know, help people out and do something creative. And so we did that little demo video, and I showed it to the people in San Francisco, and they're like, "Yeah, we want to do this." And that show became Birdhouse Factory. And Birdhouse Factory, you know, that kind of set us off on a path. And what we did in that show was we built these mechanical contraptions, and we set them in a universe. In this case, it was a factory set in the 1920s, around the time of the Great Depression. And the inspiration for the look and feel came from Diego Rivera, the Mexican muralist who people know Frida even more than they know Diego. But and here in New York, he did like the Rockefeller murals that were destroyed because they were too Marxist. You know, there was like gas masks and other things that were like considered to be propaganda in them. So they were jackhammered off the walls. But Diego Rivera did these beautiful murals of like the working culture and like these really clunky kind of images of people like in these poses, and Aloysia took those and brought those to life in choreography. Our lighting designer got this mustards and greens and this really great lighting palette. Scenic designer, who's my scenic design partner and friend in life now, Sean Riley, was our scenic designer, and he created a set that really made it, you know, that brought those murals to life. And then we looked to Chaplin in Modern Times, which was in the factory, so we brought in totally the comedy and the conveyor belt came right out of Chaplin. And Stephen Ragatz, who was a good friend of mine, he was kind of as part of our creative team and building the characters, and he had this funny idea about a runaway conveyor to kind of pay tribute to Chaplin's bit, and that became part of the show. And we had a really great experience with that, and we thought, "Oh, this is great." You know, we did this and it was successful as well.
What year is this?
And this is in 2004.
Okay.
Yeah. And all we had, though, when we finished that run was a DVD, which is a video, right? on disc, which we don't have anymore either. And that's all we had. We had pictures by a guy named Larry Rosenberg, who's the dad of Philip Rosenberg, who, if you haven't talked to him, you will at some point. He's got a circus company, and they're all based out of Montreal, doing really great work. Anyway, Philip was, at the time, he was like a young artist at the Circus Center, and he's one of the people we brought into the show, and his dad is a photographer. So we had Larry Rosenberg's photos, and we had this video of the show. And it was the most incredible experience, but then it was over.
Right.
And any circus people that get, you know, we get these opportunities to create shows, and you build this show, and it's like runs for a weekend, it runs for a week, or it runs for two, or if you're lucky, 3 or 4 weeks. But then when it's done, it's generally done. Because the next step of it is where the real impossible work of doing what we do is. And that's like figuring out how to get enough people on board to mount a tour and figuring out how to do it. And it's not easy. And it's the thing that nobody really talks about, and nobody in the circus world really knows how to do. Business people know how to do it, but they don't want any part of circus because they can make more money in other industries. So, so it's hard to get people on board who want to be your business person. So most of us as circus people have to figure it out.
So how did you figure it out?
I'm still figuring it out. You know, like it's a real challenge. It is the hardest thing. It's the hardest thing we do as a circus company, as a group of people doing circus is figuring out how to keep it going. And we were able to, I brought myself to a conference, a trade show, and set up a booth, and I built this funky little trade show booth that was like pieces from our set. You know, it wasn't like a fancy out of the box trade show booth. And so I got so much attention. I had people like stopping and sending people over going like, you gotta go see that booth. Cause I had these like gears and chains and I had a video playing and it was cool.
Where was the conference?
Super low budget. It was APAP. It was here in New York.
Oh, APAP.
Yeah. But at this time, to be honest, this was 2004 or 5 when I went to that conference, right? And at the time, people in circus, they knew Cirque du Soleil. That's all anybody wanted. Mm-hmm. So we're doing this thing that's like clunky and industrial. There's no spandex anywhere. There's no, you know what I mean? Everything is like, we took the approach of like making it cool to see how things are done rather than the fantasy side of it, right? And we set it in a real time and a real place. And this was like kind of like against the grain of what the presenters, which just wanted Cirque du Soleil in their building. They wanted Cirque on their marquee. They wanted Cirque, you know, and because they could sell that, you know, hence why Mechanical Action became Cirque Mechanics, because they needed that to sell it, you know. And it's like these little trade-offs you make, and you know, it's a difficult thing because you want to be true to what you're doing and who and how you're doing it. Mm-hmm. But man, the business side of it is huge and it's really powerful. And you got to figure it out.
Yeah.
You got to figure out what concessions you can make and all that. And luckily we got to do our thing, but man, there was a lot of pressure from the first few venues. They were like, look, we don't know how to sell this. We can't sell Birdhouse Factory. What the heck is that? You know, we need something that says circus to people. And I get it, right? Because circus become a word which people now, all these years later, now many people, although not everybody, some people still believe it's Cirque du Soleil project if there's a word circ in it. But in general, people now understand it's a genre. It describes a genre, right, of contemporary circus that is probably done in a theatrical context without animals for a bunch of reasons.
I think you're overestimating how many people can differ. Because when we say circus, everyone's like, oh, like Cirque du Soleil?
Yeah. Like, well, that's what they know. And in the age of like today where everything is like in an image in an instant, you know, this is one of the things you find out when you've got your circus show. You need to convey so much in a heartbeat. I mean, the name of the show, the name of the company, the image you choose, all this stuff is like, we're not trained for this, right? Yeah. Now, and I actually went to school for advertising right. And I feel like completely out of my depth. I have no idea, you know, naming a show, all this stuff that you just, I mean, you just stumble over this stuff.
You did a good job with the word B, though. You know, we have a show called Beyond Babel, picked B for alphabetizing. And
that's what you say that, and people be like, oh, yeah. Well, yeah, yeah, that stuff is real.
It is.
Listed up numerically right. First.
Well, our other show, Slumber, we were like, oh, shoot. We really messed up. S is so far.
Too far down.
That show
right?
is a B.
Yeah, so, you know, this is the stuff that, like, you can just kind of, we can laugh about, but, like, there are 100 things like that are just stacked against you being able to survive and thrive in a world of entertainment. Forget about circus, just entertainment in general, right? How do you stand out? How do you do your thing? How do you, you know, in the beginning, we were doing our thing, but it was a little bit too different.
Mm-hmm.
So there was so much reluctance, you know, and we got some people that got it. They were like, oh, we really like, that's really cool. But it's also hard to do the work that we created with the funding and the support of the Circus Center and then take that on the road, right? Because now I'm self-producing it. And like suddenly we brought a few artists back from China, got the visas, got it done through the help of Master Lu Yi at the Circus Center. And we got this little contract. But we didn't get everybody back. We got most everybody back. And so you're trying to do the show that when everything is perfect, you can do, but then on a limited budget with limited resources, limited time, doing that again is tougher. Mm-hmm. You know, we luckily, and we made some stumbles, you know, like along the way, we didn't have our same lighting person. And so the first theater venue, and that's why theaters in general, they kind of run the other way from new companies because mm-hmm. they're like, man, it's too much of a risk. Mm-hmm. We don't know who you are. We don't know your name. Our people, our audiences don't know who you are. So you need the right presenters that are known for taking risks or mm-hmm. doing kind of creative and, you know, unusual off the beaten path, unusual things. And when you find those people, you have to nurture those relationships, right? Mm-hmm. Because they're going to be the people that are going to be your cheerleaders in the industry. And they're going to tell the other people, hey, these guys, they know what they're doing. Yeah. They're great. Yeah, and we know they're kids, you know, and we're not kids. You know, we know they're young and they're kids, but they did a great job for us. And then you just got to keep doing it.
Did you feel, maybe it is, but did you feel pressure to make Circ Mechanics a nonprofit company?
Yeah. Well, not pressure, just like, I mean, we're just trying to figure it out, right?
Are so you a nonprofit when you,
or we're not. No, you're so when you look, yeah. you look around and you say, how do you do this, right? And people want to, they ask us all the time. It's like, like we did it because we had enormous, because of Gypsy's connection to the Circus Center and Aloysius' connection with Gypsy, mm-hmm. that allowed us to get a show up and running. And what I wanted from that was not a paycheck. I wanted to own the show.
Yeah.
I was like, look, we're going to build this show. We're going to use this content, but I want to, when we're all done, I want to be able to take that show and mm-hmm. do something with it. These machines that I feel really, really protective of, whether anybody else cares or not, they mean something to me and they're mine. And I want to make sure that we find a way to hold on to that. Mm-hmm. And so we did. And so that enabled us to then take that show and go. But we were only able to do that because they put up the money.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Like, I mean, we could not have created the show we created. We couldn't have hired the scenic designer who's a friend and would now do anything. And it's not about the money. He loves the work we do together. Mm-hmm. But in the beginning, look, we're all looking, we all need a paycheck,
right?
So we couldn't have done that work. And so we had this enormous opportunity and we grabbed it and we were able to kind of push along. But it wasn't until 2006 we got an agent that actually wanted to be on board with us. And it was somebody that had worked at a big agency that had been touring another French-Canadian circus theatrical company and theaters. And that relationship dissolved. They were looking for something that could fit in that void. Mm. And we were that company and that helped us out enormously. And then we just kind of, you know, the tours were pretty skimpy in the beginning
mm-hmm.
and they get a little bit longer. But the funny thing is, you know, people are like, oh God, you know, you guys, you've made it. People know you around the country. And we have a good reputation with artists and that we like to work with and that, you know, because we've survived and with the presenters that we work with and good partners. But it's still really hard mm-hmm. and it was really, really difficult to do. And we still struggle to figure all of that out.
Mm-hmm.
Jumping a little bit ahead, because I have so many questions about this year's show that I saw last night, but I also want to ask how you cast artists and what you're looking for in people. Because, you know, I saw the show last night and like nobody from there is from ENC or at least didn't look like it, you know, or the typical people you see.
I could ask you the question, but I think what you're saying is, so stylistically, this show is not, it's not what is popular in contemporary circus right now. I mean, I would consider us contemporary circus company, but then in some ways, very much not. And this particular show, we're paying tribute to the classic one ring circus.
Yeah.
In America, holds no ownership over that. It's, you know, European and an early American tradition, but it's the one ring circus, right? So to do that, we wanted to pay tribute to the time also, the heyday, which was, you know, in the early part of the 1900s. And so consequently, the acts don't look like what we see in contemporary circus. I would hope, and you're right, although we do have people that come from contemporary circus, from training, from ENC backgrounds and things like that. But stylistically, anyway, this show is very different from what a lot of contemporary circus is. And I think that because we've survived and because we've done work that is, in most part, we're trying to do things that are, you know, everything is derivative, right? We're all looking at other work and we're all trying to, you know, be creative with something and making it our own. But yeah, of course we're inspired by other companies and you know, the things that we see that we like, but we're trying to do our own thing. And it's been the mechanical thing. And so we'd set our first show in a factory. Second show, we're looking for, you know, we had, and we build these shows backwards in some ways because they start with the devices, because that's my background.
Oh, cool.
So with Birdhouse, we had the trolley and the spin cycle. We're like, we're going to put this in where? A factory. Okay, cool. We'll put it in the factory. The next show we had this idea for rolling trampolines, which are basically like, it's kind of like a cross of like Russian bar. It's like a moving target. These trampolines roll down tracks and people bounce on them. And the guys on the ground are moving the trampoline under the artists as they roll. Which is kind of kooky. And so we're looking, oh, we have rolling trampolines. What are we going to do with that? Okay, we could dress them up as, I don't know, as train cars. As okay, train. Oh, no, what about? Oh, and like mining carts, like old ore carts. Oh, cool. Then mining. Mining is a thing that could support some of our machines. So we set our second project in a mining town. And a little bit of the missteps, a little bit about... when you're creating work, you know, we had success with Birdhouse Record. We had a great team. And we thought, okay, we know how to do it. That worked, you know. You try the same thing again. And with Boomtown, and we tried it. And we overshot and we didn't have the same resources. And suddenly we had a tour and we went off on tour before we were ready. And we went to some markets and we got hammered because we weren't ready. And we like went back and licked our wounds and worked harder. And by the time we got the show, you know, a year and a half later, I was proud of that show. This is Boomtown. But in the beginning... there was all kinds of issues. We had artist injuries before the opening. Like we're loading into the venue where we're going to tech the show. And two artists came up to me. One came up to me and he's like standing in the back and he comes up and he takes off his earbuds. And he's like, man, I got to tell you something. I fractured my back 2 days ago. He's our trampoline guy. And then that night, one of the girls in the show, she's like, I'm pregnant. And I can't be in the show for a few months. This is like before we open, right? And we're supposed to be in Montreal in like 3 months and New York a month after that. It was tough. And we made a lot of artistic choices that, you know, we thought like, okay, we know how to do this, you know, but for the most part, contemporary circus and in our case, it's nonverbal theater, right? So we're telling stories and we tried to tell too many stories at once with Boomtown and it was hard. We had to dial that way back and we've gotten better at that and we learned, you know? And so with 42 feet, you know, now we're going back to an age of circus, which is, it's traditional, you know, and 42 feet is a reference for people that don't know. It's been the diameter of the circus ring for 250 years. And it was kind of discovered and set upon because the circus was essentially an equestrian performance back then, adding clowns and jugglers and acrobats. But that dimension was set as the standard because it was the size that they found that an acrobat could stand on horse at full gallop in a circle. And henceforth, from that day forward, it's been 42 feet.
That's so one of the fun facts the Josh told me when we first met. Do you know why a circus ring is 42 feet? And I was like, I don't know why. And now he asks me every year. I'm like, I know the answer now.
It's funny that you did that because even a lot of circus people don't really know. I mean, some people that are circus, you know, you guys are circus nuts, of course, and you've been in it your whole lives. But a lot of people that are in circus don't even know that. So for us, it's like, you know, again, back to the naming, like, and you got to be careful too. You're naming a show a year and a half out before you build the show because they need to sell it. The people that are working on your behalf are selling the show literally a year and a half before you create the show.
Right.
So you have to have a vague idea. And then sometimes you want to have a vague idea, but then they come back and that's too vague. It's like, well, look, you know.
Well, I don't know what it is yet.
It doesn't exist yet, right? So you have to build the show. And, you know, like now, because we've pulled it off a couple of times, you know, people are, you know, they're a little bit more forgiving and they go like, okay, like, all right, you say it's going to be a traditional circus show. Okay, we'll run with that, you know?
Right.
But it twists and turns and, you know, we have some ideas on what you want to do with it. You mentioned the ladder. So we're looking for acts that haven't been done a long time. Mm-hmm. I saw a photograph of that. It was on the cover of like Life magazine in like the 30s, right? And cool. It was two people balancing on the ladders. Oh, wow. We haven't seen that in a while. Mm-hmm. Right. And then, when I started at Cirque, there was a Russian swing act in Saltimbanco. To a mat, not to an apron, which is done now. And I think in some ways, there's a little kind of a point about that too. In Saltimbanco, they would fly to the roof of the tent, right? And do these crazy things, land on a drop mat in a very small space. I was blown away by that when I saw it, right? And the intimacy of the big top is something that, you know, has never left me. And when we're in these theaters, it's like, what we're always trying to do is try to create that environment. And it's really tough. Theaters are not built for circus. Mm-hmm. It's really rare that they are. You know, you have these places and there's a few of them and, you know,
maybe like Price, the Tohu.
Italy and the Tohu. And but the scale is big there. Tohu too, right? You've got other issues to deal with, right? So scale is an issue too. Anyway, I'm off track. I got to track.
Two quick things about 42. Oh. One, I thought the strongman act was the first best, only time I've ever seen that genre where I was like having so much fun watching this dude do it. Like, and I think you're just going to get ripped off probably for the neck. Whoever sees your show, I think is just, you're going to see that in other things.
I tell you what, I hope so, but I got to tell you, good luck, because I tried to find another guy that's doing what Tolga does. Yeah. For those that don't know, his name is Tolga, and I don't butcher his last name, but it's like Fatok-tok. He's a Mongolian. He's the only guy doing
Mongolian.
He's the only guy doing it. And yeah, he juggles like a 16-foot telephone pole, like it's a toothpick.
It was higher than the I don't know what you call it, but the front portal curtain.
Yeah, like, he stands it up, and when he stands it up and balances at the beginning, it's beyond the proscenium, right behind the curtain. And yeah, and if he dropped it, it would go all the way to the balcony. Like it's a big piece of wood, and it's real, and it's heavy. It's over 120 or 30 pounds, and he spins it around like spinning cube, yeah. But like. This thing is chucking along, right? And so a little backstory on that, and this is a plug too for circus in general, along with Mike Rice and Carly Sheridan, Cirque Mechanics, myself, we help with a festival in Vegas called Viva Fest. Mm-hmm. And we did our third annual a few months back, and we're going to do the fourth one this coming March. And we produce a cabaret on Saturday night, and then on Friday they have a professional gala. And so I was on the selection committee for acts. Tolga had submitted his act for this festival, and there were some people on this committee of selecting acts that felt like it wasn't hip enough.
He's so charismatic, though.
Too traditional. And I was like, really? Because he was like one of my number one picks when I saw the video. I was like, oh my God. And at this time, 2 years ago, I was just now like, we're going to do a show about vintage circus, right? Mm-hmm. And boom, I see this video. I'm like, whoa. Like, right. And as you said, strongman acts, a lot of them, like, and Coney Island strongman, and people that do that, they'll bend bars and things like that. And that's cool. But that's more like it's a much smaller thing. It's great in an intimate space and all that. But this is a big act. I mean, this thing, this is a strongman act that actually, when you're sitting in the front row, like, to this day, when I sit close and that log's chucking around, I get, like, excited. I'm, like, smiling like a little kid and scared.
Yeah.
Like, right? Because I'm like, what can happen. That log goes loose and he's going to take out the first five rows. Yeah. It's awesome.
But just dropping that bowling ball or bowling ball-like thing on in breaking the wood plank to start it with, the whole audience is like,
yeah.
And it's just like, here's the tone we're setting.
So he drops the bowling ball because everybody thinks it's fake, right? He's juggling bowling balls and he's throwing them up and catching them on his neck. And so we drop. We have a wooden thing that he drops it on so he can make noise. So people go like, oh, right.
We
have to drill that the whole act. He drops the log. You've got to send it because they don't believe
people
it.
People be like, oh, it's fake.
Just chucking that thing around. And they're like, no way, you know. Yeah. And it's sweetheart of a guy. So they say to me, oh, yeah, I don't think we're going to select them for the festival. I was like, are you crazy? Right. They're like, no. I was like, well, would you mind like if I have him for the cabaret and if he'll come? They're like, no, contact him. I was like, great. So I call him up. I said, hey. You're not going to get selected for the Pro Fest. I'd love to have you come. We do the cabaret on Saturday night. It's all circus people. We did a late night one for all the circus lay artists and all the people in shows so they could come see this thing. Uh-huh. Because a lot of this stuff is like during the weekend at night, all the competitions, Friday night is the Pro Gala and none of the artists in town can come because they're all working. So we were doing a late night thing on Saturday to have like have the old school feeling of what it used to be. When we were on tour, we'd have parties in the tent. Nothing like that.
No.
We had a DJ and we'd have like people there and we had a bar and it was like the people were coming in from the shows and we do this cabaret. So I had said to him, hey, we're doing this cabaret. Would you still like to come? He's like, yeah. And I said, look, and I'm not going to promise you anything because I don't want to be that guy, but I think we're doing a show about vintage circus and I know we're going to want a strongman and you know, this looks really amazing. So I'd love to meet you. It's like, great. Oh yeah, I want to come. So he came to my workshop, I had to go buy the piece of timber with him, shaves it, like uses a saw, cuts the whole thing, comes up with like five trash bags of five big trash cans of shavings, makes the log in about 2 hours.
Wow.
So it's round and it's, you know, what are 16, 18
one
long.
Piece?
One piece. And then we go inside and he's going to practice a little bit. So I clear a space in our shop and it's not huge, but it's you know, like we have enough space to do like our show work in there and it's warehouse. It's everything. So I'm moving these chairs around. There's like a plastic crate with some stuff in it on this chair over here. And I'm sitting here and the chair's a little bit closer than I am. And there's a few of us in there and he starts chucking the log around and the log comes around, it clips that crate and obliterates it.
Oh my God.
It goes like it's a million pieces, right? It makes this noise. And I'm just like a little kid.
Right.
Whoa! Did you see that? Right? It was like this energy, right? It was I was like, oh my God, this is gonna be incredible on the edge of the stage.
Yeah.
So he, you know, we did the cabaret and he killed, right? It was like the highlight of the whole
that's not an act that everyone sees
cabaret
all the time.
And immediately, and he was the first guy. I was like, okay, yeah, we're gonna do this show. Are you available? We want to, you know, and he's been awesome. And, you know, and then since then he did all the Got Talents and he's been all over the world doing them because it's a unique act. So fast forward to we've got our first season of 42 Feet booked, and it was miscommunication with myself and Tolga about when the dates were going to be, and he contracted himself for 10 days. So we had to do a week without him, right? And you say, like, copycats, there's nobody doing that. I mean, I looked, right? I mean, how do you find acts? We all know kind of how to search now. We talk to people.
Right.
And I couldn't find anything that was even close. There's, the only thing that's similar in some ways are those big, like, they're kind of Asians, the Mongolians and Chinese do the big ceramic pots and old jugglers and things like that. And that's kind of similar, but it's not quite as big, right? It's cool and not as big. So at that point I was like, okay, look, and this goes a little bit to casting too. So I'm not going to find this act. So what is the thing that the act gave us? Mm-hmm. It gave us energy and zing and danger for sure. Mm-hmm. It gave us tradition, old school kind of feel for sure. Also the international thing for sure. But I think the thing that that it was like, okay, danger and old school. So then I started looking again, okay, what are the old school acts that we're not seeing very much anymore? Perch Pole was one I thought of. Mm-hmm. The thing that I wanted to have in the show and didn't. Started looking for a Perch Pole act, you know, like, and this is like for all you guys in circus school, like there are none.
No,
like,
there you wanna work, are very little,
you know, projects. Like look around for acts like that aren't done.
Perch Pole style where it's like strapped to the guy's chest. It's kind of like a Chinese pole.
Exactly. Climbs it. Yeah. And they'll put like canes on top of handstands or whatever. Right. And there's a guy actually that's from the Pacific Northwest. His name is John Dutch. And he's actually, him and his partner just started doing their Perch Pole act. And I had contacted him because he was playing around with doing one. And Angela over at Muse about that. And theirs was like, it was some, they were just started doing it again.
They have a lot, it's more ladder though, right?
Yeah, well, they had just started doing it and they weren't quite ready. And I was like, not sure if we could do it in time. And so I couldn't get a Perch Pole act. And so I ended up going with a really tall, tall cane hand balance act, a friend of mine, Vladimir Malachik, out of Las Vegas. And which gave us old school, it gave us thrill and danger. It didn't give us the energy or the zing, right? I mean, the scare and the fun, right?
Yeah.
Because that's one of the things you mentioned about. I mean, we watch this act. Not only is it crazy, but we're all just like, and he is working.
Yeah.
He's sweating the whole time, and he's working, but he's grunting, and it's like this, man. There's just so much authenticity in that, and you feel it as an audience. We're always on the lookout for these things. Yeah. They don't come along in that way. And when they do, you have to kind of, you know, try to find a way to, you know, say like, let's get on board and do this.
The only show that kind of felt like a strongman-ish kind of thing, well, it was more lumber, was Sir Galfond's, what was the show we saw?
Timber.
Uh-huh. But no. Was it the second one?
Barbu?
But no, it was Timber. And we saw it maybe the third or fourth show in Montreal, and he was juggling. It was like the strongest guy.
Yeah.
And he was juggling beer kegs.
Right.
And he lost one, and it went bopping into the audience.
Let's same whole thing with circus, right? When it's not perfect, people go like, oh, wow.
I should be sitting in the front. They had a bike act too, and he like did a twirl of the bike, and the bike wheel bopped someone in but just like completely, you know, like when the wheel is more like this.
Good,
And I was like, I'm glad I'm in the balcony.
Yeah. I mean, you know, like, I think that this is all in circus community. Hopefully more and more of us are having these conversations all the time about danger and risk and, you know, where's the trade-off. Mm-hmm. And most of what we're doing and we're building is kind of human scale.
Mm-hmm.
And because we're playing in theaters and in smaller spaces and because of budgets, let's be real, practically speaking, you know, we don't have those budgets to build those big things. But consequently, it also means that the things we build are things we really connect with, mm-hmm. that we believe in and are going to work. And we have to decide, you know, which drawing are we going to execute, and we put everything into making that thing work, because it can't not work. It's got so much to build this show, that thing's got to work, right? And so you really make sure it's, you know, you can dial it in, and then in terms of scale, you know, our stuff is all man powered, right? That's one of the things that we've always done, again sometimes for budget reasons, but more in our case for kind of ideological reasons. You know, I think it's cool,
right?
And so that's the way it's evolved. And consequently, that means that our winches are not capable of you know, taking your arm out of your socket, right? And doing things that we've got multiple cables crisscrossing through the sky where people can run into problems. And there's, you know, big high profile companies on Broadway with flying acts and superheroes, and they hurt a lot of people. Mm-hmm. And anytime that happens, it's bad for all of us. Mm-hmm. And you know, in general, in circus and entertainment. And so we, you know, when we were building our Russian Swing, we were like, okay, it needs to be a certain height. Can't be too tall because they got to fly and mm-hmm. the lights are at 23 feet. You know, what are you going to do? Right.
Right.
And so we built our swing really low to the ground. Well, that's for anybody who's ever done Russian Swing, and for you don't know what Russian Swing is, it's essentially, if you imagine like a, I don't know, almost like the size of a surfboard on a swing set, swinging back and forth with people standing on it. The guy in the back is pushing, and the person on the front is flying through the air, yeah. right?
Really getting launched.
Really getting launched,
yeah.
right? And that's what it's all about. And this act, so back to Salt and Bungo, yep. I was, you know, we hadn't seen Russian Swing in theaters in small spaces.
No.
And Cirque du Soleil and some of the big boys, they'll do these big acts in enormous spaces, why they use the aprons, which is cool because you can have flight that is like enormous. Mm-hmm. But I got to tell you, I like seeing people land on their feet and stick mm-hmm. it. Right. I mean, that's to me, and you get more flight time because yeah. if you go into an apron, you fly and before, right after the apex, you're landing on this thing.
About hearing the smack of the mat
and the mat.
Yeah.
Yeah. And seeing people, you know, and understanding that like they're on their feet. Mm-hmm. And that's people, audiences get that's success.
Right? Yes.
And so we really wanted to make that part of it. So the swing had to be a certain size, which means it's now on the floor. Well, we all know, anybody that's done Russian Swing knows, when you fall off, because it will happen, when you go straight up and you come down the path of the swing, lay down. So it'll swing over the top of you. Mm-hmm. Everybody knows that. That's why swings are built that way. We couldn't build our swing that way.
Right.
So how do we keep people safe?
The handbrake I saw.
Yeah. So we have a motorcycle brake on there. I've got disc brakes on it. Do two disc brakes on it. And that allows for the pusher and the height of the push. Something goes wrong, you can grab the brake and it won't stop it in place, mm-hmm. but it stops it on the backswing so that before it can come back forward and clip somebody.
I was wondering what those brakes. I was wondering what those brakes were for. I was like, is that going to be in the act? That we see somebody do that?
Yeah, and like sometimes you, like when you build something like that, it becomes part of the act. Yeah. Other times it's just there
safety
for something goes wrong. Nobody knows. The audience doesn't know. It looks cool. I mean, scenically it looks cool. It does look kind cool, of like yeah. of our world. But that's an example of like where you, like you got to look for the things that can go wrong. Right. And part of the other reason is how have we figured it out? We're still doing it because we, you know, knock on wood, we've got the right people and had the right people helping us to keep people safe because, because mm-hmm. not only would we be not doing this anymore, but we'd not be doing circus any favors if we hurt people.
Right. No, of course.
Well, you have to run to a show shortly. So I want to quickly get the three questions in that we ask every single guest. The first one being, was there a piece of advice, either really good or really terrible, that you got that stuck with you?
Man, I would say that the thing that motivated me most was one of the early, my early experiences at Cirque du Soleil, where I had a choreographer working with me who had no patience for me. I wasn't a dancer. I couldn't move. And she basically just dumped me and off to somebody else who worked with me. And we mentioned this earlier with Kidam, how it evolved. And that act, the German Wheel Act, became kind of this urban street maniacal kind of character guy. And the look and feel of it was very much from my BMX days. And I fought with the creative team on that because they had pictured that German guy doing this really slick, suave thing that I just couldn't do. And I tried to do it. I just couldn't do it. You know? And I got such like, I mean, there was so much like, I felt so incompetent, so terrible. And then finally, just before opening, Jill came to me and he said, Chris, you know, this thing, it's not working. do it the way you would do it, right? And I did it the way that I, you know, the BMX way. And right away, Franco saw something in that. And then he made it much bigger and better than I would have done, you know. But my instinct was to play it much more street and much more like in your face. Mm-hmm. And Franco like yelled out, go get him a hat. So he got a bowler hat. Go get Dima's hat. Got a bowler hat. Get him some gloves. And then do it again. And then it became like, and the look and feel was like Clockwork Orange all of a sudden. Mm-hmm. And anybody knows Clockwork Orange. I mean, it's a maniacal character, right? But there's something about that, like the bowler hat down over the eyes, looking under the right under the brim, and like looking at staring in, staring people down in the front row. And that became what that character was. So I got to do that. So in the beginning, it motivated me because I was like, no, I can do this. You know, like, I mean, I felt terrible. I got beaten down. It was a really tough process. I felt horrible. But I felt like I know this is going to work. Mm-hmm. And in some ways, like, you know, some of that stuff motivated me to make it work. And it did.
That's history right there. Yeah. So,
but that can either kill a performer. It's interesting. Either a performer dies through that or rises.
I did feel like I was from the ashes. I died. I felt like I was so crushed, and I had really good friends. My friends I'd been working with. They're like, no, it's gonna be okay. Do you know what he means is do this, or I'll help you or whatever, you know? And I managed to do it long enough for somebody else to be like, oh yeah, there's a spark of something there. Let's make that bigger. And Franco Dragone, for anybody who doesn't know, I mean, he's a genius like that. I mean, just amazing.
His shows are incredible.
So we have a lot of people listening to the podcast who are students of circus and circus school or in Smirkus or other youth kinds of programs. Is there a show or a book or a movie that you would recommend as a reference to somebody trying to learn about circus?
To learn about circus.
Or be inspired.
Which you can't say a Cirque Mechanic show.
No, I wouldn't do that.
But it's at Newvik.
Right now.
Right, right. I see everything I can see. There's not really one work that stands out or one movie. I mean, I've seen them all from The Greatest Show on Earth, you know. To anything with circus in it, Chaplin. I mean, all of these things from the old days and the new days. And, you know, watch Philippe Petit walking across the Twin Tower. I mean, everything about circus, any video, anything. I think that's what helped me the most is to try to like suck up every bit of circus from everywhere, from every walk of life, from every background, from everything, to try to have as most complete understanding. I don't know that there's one. PBS did a thing a little while ago on circus that I thought was really good. I think it was 200 Years of Circus. And it may have been, I will tell you this about the book that I have, which I think you had, Dominic.
Dominic Shindo,
Fantastic book. And that book, like, if you don't have it.
The coffee table one, the big one.
Okay. I have the small version too.
I do too.
Because I couldn't haul around that big one anymore. Yeah. My wife was like, you've got to stop bringing this big one around.
So can we just use the little one? And Josh like, no.
But the big one. So Dominic, of course, like, he's assembled this book with other great people in circus. So that for me, like, as a reference, if there's like a book, I would be like, get that book. The images in it. There were pictures of Ladder that we looked at in that book. There's all this great old school stuff. For people in circus schools, I would encourage them to like look through this old stuff to find ways to find a device that you're not seeing everywhere anymore. You know, there's a bunch of them. People ask me, you know, and you know, what are you not seeing as much of anymore? You know, or what's, you know, wow, man, I'm having a hard time getting work. It's like, well,
you're another silk artist.
You created another act that you know, like there were 30 other people training that same act right next to you in school. I mean, right. When you get out of school, you're all looking for the same gig, right? So, you know, try to look for some of these old things, you know. Ooh. Sometimes go back or approach it completely differently. Look out in the universe for things that you might be able to do circus on.
It sounds like, you know, for those who are listening, trying to figure it out, there's a lack of strongmen out there. So
right.
Yeah,
and old school acts, you know, it's gotten increasingly difficult. And this is sadly going to affect circus producers and audiences for a long time. We, you know, for in a lot of good ways, you know, the government-sponsored system, you know, when the Soviet Union stopped supporting circus the way they did, Eastern Europe, you know, they would be these great, big, huge group acts all the time coming out of Eastern Europe. They don't exist anymore. They're getting increasingly difficult. If you have a group act, you've got to build it yourself, which if you're a small company,
very hard.
That means everybody here has to suddenly be doing flights on Russian Swing, you know, like, I mean, it's a real challenge.
Yeah.
And that's one of the things that has changed in the past 10 years that makes it harder and harder. When you see these group acts, we all appreciate them because they're so rare.
Yeah.
And so wonderful. You know, there's a great one right now. It's a great flying act, the Ukrainian act that's in Big Apple right now.
Oh my gosh. Amazing. Crazy. Right.
The rigging is beautiful.
The rigging is so cool.
It's amazing. I could watch them like do that set and strike. Like, it's awesome.
Did you hear how they built it in Jersey? And then the guy came to inspect it and was like, this is not going to pass.
No way.
And it was like, took out a ton of seats, and then they had to rethink it. And then it it worked. I mean, it's watching the act is one thing, and then watching all the rigging and all the coordination, because
what I really like about it is the rigging's part of the act, right? And
yeah.
And from what you know about what I've told you and what you know about our work, I mean, that's like, to me, that's cool. Like, and they make it beautiful. Mm-hmm. I mean, it is like, you know, it's a, for those of you who haven't seen it, won't get to see it. And you might not, because it's a group act that's at that show for a certain period of time. And then these acts have a hard time getting work because yeah. there's suddenly nine people who do one act and maybe there's a couple of other acts they do, but, suddenly they're looking for work and it's right. harder and harder to find organizations other than one, two big companies that can snatch up right. these acts.
And in a tent.
And that yeah. those one, two big companies are buying up all the medium sized ones.
Yeah.
That's true. There's when we did our show Slumber, we had to set up a Chinese pole during the show, but it was like we couldn't hide it. So it was just part of it.
Yeah.
And a lot of people wrote critic reviews were like, oh, it was so cool to see. And then one guy just ripped us apart. It was like, I had to watch this with no payoff getting rigged up. And I was like, I'd like to see you rig a Chinese right. pole yeah. quicker and right. like see if you yeah. can do it.
That's, you know, we will. I mean, it's one of those things that in our case, part of the show, we have a setup of Russian swing, mm-hmm. right? And proud of the fact that we do Russian swing with no anchor points, no guy wires, right? This Russian swing comes out, this big, our circus ring turns around and we lock it down and the weight of that thing holds the Russian swing in place. And that's really, this is the kind of stuff you learn about touring in theaters, right? Got to get in and out because you got to load in one day. In 2 hours, you got to build your whole show. And we bring stuff, right? Mm-hmm. This stuff is big and clunky. So Russian swing has to be able to set up without guy wires. We can't drill into the floor. We can't put right. anchors down. This doesn't really happen very often. Mm-hmm. So our swing is heavy. And
yeah, it looks really cool.
And it's locked into our what we call the carousel with these two bars that just come in. Mm-hmm. And we lock it into that. And that's how we hold it in place. And that makes – but that's part of the set. We have to we have a whole scene. It's a minute mm-hmm. long where our circus ring turns around and the yeah. entire cast is on it. And you can make it cool. I mean, I think yeah. it looks
I mean, I think we could have made it better in hindsight. You know, it's like when you think back, you're like, that was
yeah.
probably we could have made that better. Maybe he had a point, but you know, whatever. So the last question is, I mean, you always have one name, but if you can suggest who we should have on our podcast.
Oh, we're working together or not, that I've worked with in the past, maybe?
Anybody in the circus community you think is an interesting person to talk to?
I would
to?
Say, you know, I have the most respect for everybody. The people that I mentioned that are on our creative team are, yeah. are absolutely fantastic. If you've not spoken with Aloysia,
she's
been, one of the most recommended
yeah,
people.
We have to get her on.
Aloysia. Steve Ragatz, who's based in Vermont. He's also, he's a juggler. He was on Kidan with me. A red ball juggling.
Oh,
he actually yeah. Him and Patrick McGuire.
So did Pat do his act?
In what show?
In Kidam.
Yes. Yeah, so they did. They both subbed. They both became a backup act doing the father character. But that act was actually created from Astaire. They did an act for Michael Motion, who's in the world
yeah.
of physical prop object mm-hmm. manipulation. He's the guru and the genius, and they worked with him and Circus Lady to create an act. The spinoff of that became adopted into Kidam, and then they killed the group act when they took that show to Europe, and then Pat and Steve did solo versions of that act for Cirque, but then they each did solo versions of it for Birdhouse Factory. Steve was our boss character
yes.
with a bowler hat and the Daddy Warbucks kind of thing with a briefcase and all that manipulation, and he became, you know, and then the funny thing and the great thing is Pat and Steve are partners, and so Pat would be on Kidam doing the act and Steve would be with us, and then Steve would be like, you know, Pat would like need a break of that or, you know, need
yeah.
to go back with Cirque for a while. And then Steve would come
cool.
and do Birdhouse Factory. And so they were interchangeable for a long time.
I feel
time.
Like I saw Pat in it when I saw
you
it.
You did. You yeah. saw it in New York. You saw yeah. Pat because Steve was on the Cirque du Soleil job for that like 6 month period.
Yeah.
And but so we work with Steve. So Steve has been kind of our, I mean, a dramaturge is the official word for it. We all kind of collaboratively mm-hmm. create these projects together. There's no real super hard lines drawn. But,
do you find that that's hard though?
It is.
Because that's how we work, but it's hard to explain to a person who's on the outside coming in. It's like, no, we're all the directors. We're
yeah,
all the creators.
It's
like,
but we all have our own special. So Steve is absolutely the writer,
mm-hmm.
right? I mean, he absolutely has the, you know, we kind of set the idea or the premise for the place. And then Steve kind of will create some kind of narrative thread,
mm-hmm.
some ideas. And he'll throw them out and we push back and say, what if we do this? And then he scratches his head and gets mad at me and he goes like, you know, he goes away. And then he comes back like an hour later with something absolutely awesome, you know, that I never would have thought of. Maybe it's a solution to how, what we need, you know, some physical thing we need to fix or something like that. He's fantastic. And he's in Vermont. I'm sure he'd love to talk to you guys.
Yeah, we'd love to go to Vermont.
Okay, that's it. Chris, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. It's a pleasure talking to you.
Nice to talk to you guys.
And that was our interview with Chris Lashua.
If you like our show, make sure to Twitter tweet us, follow us on Instagram, rate us on iTunes, or email us at hello@hideawaycircus.com.
And don't forget to get your tickets to Beyond Babel, our show opening off-Broadway in New York City on January 21st. Use the discount code PODCAST at checkout for 15% off.
Have a good week. Our podcast is also available on Circus Talk, the international circus community's online resource and employment tool. If you are not a member yet, register and find your spotlight with Circus Talk today.